This is your life, episode 50. This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Are you who you wanna be? This is your life. Is everything you dreamed it would be when the world was younger and you had everything? Hello and welcome to this episode of This Is Your Life. My name is Michael Hyatt and this is the podcast dedicated to intentional leadership. My goal is to help you live with more passion, work with greater focus, and lead with extraordinary influence. Well, today is a huge milestone for me. It marks my 50th episode. I can't believe it. Like most projects, I've gone through a full range of emotions on this one. I had initial elation at the prospect of starting a podcast, then eventual discouragement, wanting to quit, to where I am now, where I'm loving podcasting. I'm fully committed to it as a major component of my own platform. And I want to give a special shout out to Dan Miller, Andy Traub, and Cliff Ravenscraft, all of whom encouraged me to podcast and helped me along the way. So thanks, guys. I could not have done this without you. Well, in this episode, I'm going to be talking about 8 leadership lessons from a symphony conductor. And this is one of the best metaphors I've ever seen for leadership. And I'm going to have some really practical ways you can lead your team more effectively and some terrific questions from my listeners. But first, this podcast is brought to you by Platform University, an online membership site for helping you launch your personal platform or take it to the next level. You can find out more at platformuniversity.com. And if you're already a member, be sure and check out the new member makeover screencast that I posted earlier this week. One of our members, who is an attorney, asked me to review his platform, including his blog and his use of social media. And I made, I think, some surprising recommendations that might even make you rethink some of your own conclusions about your platform. So with that, let's get right into this episode. You know, a while back, Gail and I went to the Nashville Symphony with our daughter Mary and her husband Chris, and Mary had bought us tickets for Gail's birthday, and it was a magnificent evening. The symphony took place at Nashville's world-renowned Skimmerhorn Symphony Center, which, if you get a chance, take a look at the skimmerhorncenter.com website. It's incredible. But the orchestra was conducted by the renowned Hugh Wolf. He and the orchestra performed Beethoven's Concerto No. 4 in G major for piano and orchestra, and then Horacio Gutierrez played the piano. And after the intermission, the orchestra performed Rachmaninoff's Symphonic Dances, Opus 45. And I want to play just about 60 seconds of that piece so you can imagine you're at the symphony with me, and it'll really set up the rest of the show today. So just listen in. Imagine this. We had seats on the second row of that concert. I was less than 20 feet from Hugh Wolf. I was completely swept up into the experience, and I was especially fascinated to watch how he led the orchestra. I mean, it was unbelievable. Well, toward the end of the evening, it occurred to me that conducting an orchestra and leading a team have much in common. In fact, this analogy has become so powerful to me that I can't hardly talk about leadership anymore without referring to this example. So let's dive in. Here are 8 leadership lessons you can learn from a symphony conductor. Lesson number 1, start with a plan. You know, conductors have their own version of this. They start with a musical score and a clear idea in their head of how it should sound. And only then do they attempt to recreate in real time their musical vision. Well, as a leader, you've got to start with a vision too. What is it you're trying to create? Do you have clarity about the destination to which you're trying to take your team? You know, we hear lots of talk in corporate world about strategy. And don't get me wrong, strategy is important, but vision is even more important. And vision is what you set out to achieve. Strategy is how you intend to achieve it. And if you have a clear, compelling vision, the right strategy will show up. And if you don't, then you've got no way to evaluate strategy. So it always starts with strategy. And I would just encourage you to read a blog post I wrote a while back entitled, Why Vision is More Important Than Strategy. And there's a link in the show notes for you. So lesson number one, start with a plan. Lesson number two, recruit the best players. You know, great conductors attract great players. Mediocre conductors attract mediocre players. The very best players want to work for the very best conductors. Like attracts like. The same is true in leadership. As a leader, you've got to attract, recruit, train, and develop the very best people you can find. And you got to recruit people for the organization you're intending to build, not the organization you have currently. Recruit people who have been to the mountain, so to speak, and know the trail, and let them help you get there. So recruit the very best leaders. Lesson number three, and this one's so important, be visible so everyone can see you. You know, the conductor stands on a platform so that every single member of the orchestra can see him, and this is the only way the orchestra can stay in alignment with each player starting and stopping at the appropriate time. And as a leader, you can't keep your organization in alignment if you hide in your office and never mingle with the troops, so to speak. You have to be visible and present. And by the way, an interesting point for those of you in ministry, and I've got a lot of people in ministry that listen to my broadcast, Jesus didn't just recruit the disciples, give them a job to do, and then disappear into the desert to pray. No, he really kind of did the reverse. He came out of the desert, and according to Mark 3:14, chose the 12 that they might be with him. Well, being with, that concept is the primary way you lead people. You know, it's not the brilliance of your vision, though that's important. It's not your strategy that's so critical, though that's important too. But it's really your ability to be with people in a way that inspires them to do more than they would do otherwise. You can't do this exclusively via email, telephone, or even Skype. Those can help, but you've got to be present with people face-to-face if you're going to lead well. So lesson number three, be visible so everyone can see you. Lesson number four, lead with your heart. You know, great conductors like Hugh Wolf are swept up in the music. They're passionate. They don't just play with their head, they play with their heart. You can read it on their face and you can sense it in their movement. They're fully present and they're playing full out. Well, as a leader, your heart is the most important leadership asset you possess. And it's so important that I devoted an entire podcast episode to it. It's episode 35, The Importance of the Leader's Heart. There's a link in the show notes. And I won't repeat what I said there, but I encourage you to listen to it. I discuss five truths about the heart and four disciplines of the heart. And it's critical that you understand this as a leader. Your effectiveness as a leader is totally dependent on the condition of your heart and whether or not you bring that to your team. So lesson number four, lead with your heart. Lesson number five, delegate and focus on only what you can do. You know, the conductor doesn't do everything. He doesn't sell the tickets. He doesn't participate, usually in the preliminaries. He doesn't even make sure that the orchestra is in tune. The concertmaster does that. He stays off the stage until it's time for him to do what only he can do, which is to lead the orchestra. And as a leader, the same must be true of you. You've got to learn to delegate. It's critical. Nothing will keep you stuck as a leader more than the inability to delegate. And maybe you're thinking, well, I can't delegate because I can't afford to hire additional help. Or maybe you're thinking, I don't delegate because it takes me longer to explain how to do it than just do it myself. Or maybe you're thinking, I don't delegate because it's easier to do it myself. Well, I address also those issues and more in episodes 42 and 43 of this podcast. And I also wrote a follow-up blog post called, and listen to this, see if this doesn't describe what you want, how to do more of what you love and less of what you don't. And I'm going to tell you, the secret is delegation. That's one of the skills that as a leader, if you're going to move up and if you're going to accomplish all that you need to accomplish and what you want to accomplish, you've got to learn to delegate. And there's a link to that blog post in the show notes. So lesson number five, delegate and focus on only what you can do. Lesson number six, be aware of your gestures and their impact. This is subtle. A conductor can't afford to make an unintentional gesture. I mean, everything means something. The flick of the wrist, the raising of the eyebrow, the closing of the eyes, all have meaning. And a good conductor can't afford to be careless with his public demeanor. And as a leader, you have to be conscious of your nonverbal communication as well. I remember a few years ago when I was in a monthly business review at Thomas Nelson, and this is a review in which we had all the different division heads appear before the executive committee and kind of give an account for what had happened in the previous month and where they saw their division going for the next month and the next year. And so we did this once a month. And I remember I had a consultant by the name of Eileen with me in one of these business reviews. And at one of the breaks, she pulled me aside and she said, "Can I tell you something? And I want to really be candid." And I said, "Sure, what is it?" She said, "Are you mad at somebody?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you should see your face because you look mad. You got this scowl, your lips are pursed." And she said, "It looks like you're angry with these people and it's sucking the wind out of them." Well, I was so grateful. I had no idea. My heart definitely wasn't connected to my face because that's not how I felt. I was just kind of intense. And she went on to coach me. She said, "You know, you need to smile. You need to be warm. You need to be nodding. You need to be engaging even non-verbally." Well, that was huge for me. And I remember another time I had Brian Shearer, who's one of my managers, pull me aside after a speaking event. And he said, "You've got to smile more." And Gail's told me that a lot too. And so I've really been trying to work on smiling when I speak. Now, why am I doing this? Because I'm aware that gestures have a huge impact, that my nonverbal communication has a huge impact. And so you don't need to get paranoid about this, but you've got to recognize that people interpret your gesture. They impute far more meaning to these gestures and to these nonverbal cues than probably you intend. But as a leader, as a good leader, you've got to be aware and you've got to be intentional and you've got to create an environment where people can speak the truth to you and the people that are closest to you can tell you what you're communicating with your nonverbal gestures so you're not inadvertently undermining what you're intending to communicate. So lesson number six, be aware of your gestures and their impact. Lesson number seven, keep your back to the audience. Now, conductors are aware of the audience, but their focus is on the players and their performance. And the only time the conductor stops to even acknowledge the audience is before the playing begins and after it's finished. Other than that, he's focused on delivering an outstanding product. And as a leader, you obviously can't afford to ignore the market. You have to be aware of them and what they want. But, and this is a crucial distinction, that can't be your primary focus. Not if you're going to wow them and ultimately deliver what they want, which is an outstanding performance. You have to focus on the product that you're creating, and even more importantly, the team you're creating it with. If you develop your team, you'll create a great product. And if you create a great product, you'll have happy customers, happy constituents, and it will all work. But you've got to keep your back to the audience, so to speak, and not allow that to become your primary focus. Lesson number eight, share the spotlight. You know, when the concert's over and the audience is clapping, the conductor turns to the audience and he takes a bow. A good conductor immediately turns to the orchestra and invites them to stand and bow as well. He shares the glory with his colleagues, realizing that without them, the music would not be possible. I mean, if the conductor walks to the stage with only his baton, how much music can he produce without the orchestra? Well, none. Absolutely none. He needs the orchestra. He can't do it without them. This is the personification of a team effort. Well, as a leader, you must make sure that others get the credit. You must brag on your people. Do it in private. Do it in public. And write this down if you can. You get more of what you notice and affirm. It's true in marriage, it's true in parenting, And it's especially true in leading a team. And here's why this works. People will break their neck to live up to your expectations. And one of the things that drives human behavior is standards. If you set a high standard, not an impossible one that frustrates people, but a high one that causes people to stretch and reach and develop their potential, you'll get extraordinary performance. But you've got to share the spotlight, and that's really where it starts. If people know that you're willing to do that and you're not going to take all the glory for yourself, they'll work their heads off to make you happy and to be part of a team that plays a game at that level. So, 8 lessons from a symphony conductor. Who knew the world of music had so much to teach us as leaders? But it does. Leadership lessons are everywhere if only we look. Well, several years ago, I went to a leadership conference hosted by Gap International. It was called the Alignment Intensive, and I have a link in the show notes. But it's one of the best conferences I've ever attended, and I took my entire executive team. And on one evening, they brought in the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra and let us sit with the players. It was an incredible experience. You might want to do the same thing as a leader. Take your team to a symphony and then get together and discuss these leadership lessons and find out what else you discover. I'm sure there's more. These are only 8. There's probably a lot more lessons as well. But to ask people what they noticed and how it applies to leadership and then just sit back and guide the conversation, you'll find that this would be an incredible experience for you as a leadership team as it was for my team when we did it with the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. Well, so with that, let's get to some listener questions. Man, I had so many listener questions, more than any other show previously, and probably because I offered to send to everyone whose question I used on the show an autographed copy of my book, Platform, Get Noticed in a Noisy World. One thing that I want to point out, if you did leave a question and I did use it on the show, if you're one of the people that I'm about to use on the show, please email my assistant with your shipping address, and her name is Trisha, and you can reach her at Trisha@MichaelHyatt.com. Send her your shipping address so we can get a copy of this autographed book out to you. The first question comes from Adam.
Hi, Michael. This is Adam Rico from Sacramento, California, and I blog at workyouenjoy.com. Michael, for someone who has aspirations to move into an executive position in their career, what would you recommend they do now to prepare themselves for an opportunity later? Thank you so much for your podcast, and I look forward to hearing your response.
Adam, thanks for this question. I would recommend a couple of things off the top of my head. Number one, make sure that you're developing yourself personally and professionally. Take every advantage to read leadership books, to go to conferences, even if you have to pay for them on your own, but make sure that you're growing and developing and expanding your capacity as a leader. Second thing I would do is learn. Be an active learner. Sit in meetings and take notes. Be attentive. Third thing I would recommend, deliver on your promises. Make sure that you're being responsive to people and deliver on your promises, because those are the people in organizations who get more responsibility are the people who are being responsible and good stewards of what they've already been given. Next question comes from Ben.
Hi, Michael. This is Ben Nielsen from productivitypad.blogspot.com. My question is, how much does a leader need to know about the individual specialties of each of his teammates? I know it's important to know what's going on with each part of any project that you're doing, but it's also not good to be a micromanager. So I'm just wondering, how much should you know about each of your teammates' specialties? Thanks.
I'm not sure, Ben, that I fully understand your question. I think it could go one of two ways. I'm not sure if you're asking about, should you know about your team members' strengths and then make sure that you're playing them in positions and on projects that can reflect those strengths, or if you're asking about micromanaging and delegation. I'm going to assume the first. Besides, that's the answer I want to give. So here's what I would say. I would say that you do need to understand your team members' strengths, because team members come in a variety of configurations, so to speak. And I would recommend the book Strength Finders 2.0. Allow each of your teammates, especially your direct reports, to take the Strength Finders test and find out where they are particularly strong. And you're hopefully going to have a wide array of strengths across your team. And like a symphony conductor, you can then call up the individual strengths that you need on various projects and make sure that people are playing to those strengths and that you don't have them in an area that really requires something that they're weak in. And if you really want to go all out, I would get the full battery of 34 strengths. You're only going to get the top 5 if you take the basic test. But if you pay a little bit more, I think it's like $80 or $90, you get all 34 strengths. And it will not only tell you the strengths of each of your team members, but their weaknesses. So you want to keep them out of those areas that they're weak in and really focused on the areas they're strong in. And this will also be a great aid for you in hiring so that you can round out your team with the strengths that may not be currently represented in the assembly of people that you have together now. So hopefully that's helpful. Gary's got the next question.
Hi, Michael. This is Gary Moreland in Charlotte. I blog at GaryMoreland.com. And my question, any advice on getting a team that has a variety of gifts and skills and opinions and experience, getting that team to see more and more the big picture and to more and more perform together as one and to be invested and passionate about the outcome and to less and less think of themselves as playing individual notes because it's your job? Thank you.
Gary, in my experience, this is almost 100% your responsibility is to get your team aligned and to keep them aligned. And the way that you do that is by continually articulating the vision, helping people see the big picture. And this means you've got to speak the vision into existence. You've got to constantly be talking about it, so much so that you're going to get sick of hearing yourself talk about the vision. But when you start getting sick to yourself about hearing yourself talk about the vision, you're about half done. You need to keep speaking the vision. And you need to be calling people to that vision and enrolling them in the vision so that they've got something bigger than themselves to align to and makes them sublimate, not eradicate, but sublimate their own interest in service of the larger vision and what you're trying to create together as a team. Hanno has the next question.
Hi, Michael. My name is Hanno Vanderbale. I live in Mobile, Alabama, and I blog at thathealingvoice.wordpress.org. My question on leadership is, how do you adapt to other people's work habits if you are an introvert? For example, I tend to expect people to know what to do and how to do it by themselves because that's the way I tend to work. But I found that some people around me prefer to do tasks with me rather than on their own. How do you adapt your leadership style to different people around you? Thank you for mentoring me through your podcast. I look forward to your response.
I think as a leader, you have to be willing to adapt your style if you're going to lead your team well. I mean, you can be a good leader and expect other people to adapt their style to yours, but you can't be a great leader that way. You've got to understand what people need and then become somewhat of what they need in order to maximize the opportunity. Let me just say a word about introverts and extroverts. And I've always thought of myself as an introvert. And I think that is my natural tendency, but I personally don't think this is something you're born with. I think it really is a collection of behaviors that we generally express or have a preference for. But I often see it. I'm not saying you're doing this, but for me at least, it used to be an excuse. You know, well, that's just the way I am, and I'm an introvert. I draw energy from being on my own. I don't like to be with groups, whatever. But the problem is that being an introvert doesn't always serve me well. Sometimes being an extrovert is a much better option or series of choices that I can make that serve the cause, serve my team, and really serve ultimately what I'm trying to create in the world. So I would just say to you, and again, not you, Hanno, but to anyone who's listening to this who may be thinking that that becomes an excuse or something that limits you in your expression, I would just say rethink that. Because it may not always be serving you the best. And so when I've got teammates, for example, that want to do things with me, or a wife, and this is very much my case, where I've got a wife that wants to do things with me, I'm the one that needs to adapt. I just can't say, well, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm an introvert. You know, that's lame, to be honest. That's not always the best choice. And those things that we label are oftentimes just the choices that we choose to make in those situations most of the time. But they don't have to be. And we don't have to lock ourselves into them. The next question comes from Jim.
Hi, Michael. This is Jim Ryan in Merrimack, Massachusetts. And I blog at softskillsforhardjobs.com. And I'm interested in your thoughts on what a leader should do when they have department heads that aren't playing nice with each other. Thanks.
Jim, great question. I was just at Merrimack College in North Andover, Massachusetts. Had a terrific time there speaking on the topic of platform. But what should a leader do when his department heads aren't playing nicely with one another? I think there's a couple of things. One is, I think as a leader, again, it goes back to the vision. You've got to articulate something that's bigger than their individual interests and help them see how their part plays into the whole, how they can contribute, but it's really not an end game for them just to run their department well. You're trying to serve a bigger function, and I think it's your role as the leader to articulate that and make sure that they understand the larger context in which they're operating. Now, if you're doing that on a consistent basis and you're still not getting not only cooperation, but you're not getting the different parts aligned, then I think sometimes you have to confront the behavior outright and you have to express what's not working. I remember, again, when I was the CEO at Thomas Nelson, I had a division head. He'd been there for a long time. And he was really at cross purposes with the culture that I was trying to create. And, you know, I kept talking about the context. I kept talking about the larger vision. He just wasn't picking up on it for whatever reason. And I finally had to just sit down with him and say, look, your behavior is at odds with what we're trying to create here. And it wasn't immoral behavior. It was just at odds with the culture that I wanted to create. And he was a little stunned, frankly, but he needed the wake-up call, and I needed to have the courage as the leader to have that difficult conversation. And in his case, he did improve for a while, and then I had to confront it again. Ultimately, I'm sorry to say that we had to get rid of this guy because he was not willing to play a bigger game than this small game about winning with his division at everybody else's expense. He was not willing to give that up for the sake of everybody winning on the team. So, you know, we got in somebody that that would do that, and sometimes you'll be forced to make those same kinds of decisions, but not before you cast a vision, not before you have the difficult conversation. The next question comes from Kim.
Hi, Michael. This is Kim Avery from KimAveryCoaching.com, and I have a question about leadership today. I'm in active participation in an organization that I would really like to see some changes made, but I am not the person at the top or the person in the primary position of leadership. And so I was wondering what your suggestions are in terms of the best ways to lead an organization from underneath. Thanks so much for your help.
Kim, this is a terrific question because most of us find ourselves leading from the middle. There are really no true autocrats, at least in the corporate world and probably in the nonprofit world as well. Even when I was a CEO, I had a board of directors. And in fact, I used to think that becoming a CEO, I would suddenly have total freedom and no accountability and I could do whatever I wanted. Well, that wasn't true at all. In fact, I went from having one boss to having eight bosses because I had eight members on my board. So most of us are leading from the middle. We're trying to influence people that have either more resources, more power, or more status than we do. And it's entirely possible. In fact, I think it's the essence of leadership is being able to influence anyone, no matter where they are in the food chain. But here's what has to happen. Now, think of yourself as a leader. Think of the people you're leading and who has credibility with you, who influences you. And I think it's people, generally speaking, who have personal integrity, who have outstanding performance, and who have people who have courage to speak up and have those difficult conversations, or people that are willing to at least give you candor and give you the truth when you need it the most. And the same will be true for you as you're trying to influence the people above you. Make sure that you have that personal integrity, obviously. Make sure that you have outstanding performance because that earns you the right to be heard. And then speak into those situations, not in a disrespectful way or definitely not in a cynical way, but in a way that makes it clear to the person you're trying to influence that you really are committed to everyone's best and you're committed to their best as well, which brings me to another point, which means you've got to frame it in terms of what's important to them, not what's important to you, but to help them get what they ultimately want. And if you can frame it in that way, you've got a much higher probability of success. The next question comes from Mike.
Hi, Michael. This is Mike St. Pierre from thedailysaint.com. Really love the podcast. And my question is this. As a leader, I'm always trying to help my direct reports work independently. How do I help them work independently without completely relinquishing my role as their leader? Thanks so much for the podcast. Look forward to your response.
Mike, the short answer to that question is you have to inspect and not just delegate, but delegate and inspect what you've delegated. And I talk about this in episode 42, The Fine Art of Delegation, where I talk about the five levels of delegation. And I would encourage you to go back and listen to that if you haven't. But you don't want to abdicate. You want to stay in the involved, especially at the early stages, and make sure that the work is being performed in a way that you're going to be pleased with, so you don't get to the end of the project, suddenly discover and are surprised to find that it's not even close to what you expected. You got to be clear on the assignment, inspect along the way, and then review at the end and ask what you can do better the next time around. The next question comes from Tara.
Hello, Michael. This is Tara Crisco calling from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm a leadership coach, and my website is taracrisco.com. I work with a lot of leaders who lead in very matrix reporting structures. So my question is, what tips do you have for leaders who are conducting a symphony where the orchestra members play for many conductors and the reporting structure is loosely defined? Thank you so much.
You know, most of my experience as a leader has been in matrix organizations where there have been either service groups or other teams that have had to serve more than one leader. So this is really common. I think that people experience this at a lot of different levels. And I know when I was a leader who was trying to fight for resources that I didn't entirely control, there were certain things that I had to do as a leader. One is that I had to cast a compelling vision. You know, it seems to always come back to that, so that the people that I was trying to recruit could get it, could get the bigger picture, and they found it compelling and wanted to participate. Because at the end of the day, all those people, everybody in an organization, I don't care even if you're getting paid a lot of money, is a volunteer. You can coerce some minimal level of behavior or performance, but if you want their heart and their best work, you've got to remember as a leader, they're a volunteer, and they're only going to enlist or enroll themselves if you cast a compelling vision. That's so critical. And then I also would make sure that you're affirming and really acknowledging their hard work, because most people are not working for the money. I mean, the money's got to be a component, but that's not the thing that drives them. What they want is other things like recognition, acknowledgement, empathy. And I think if you're competing for those resources, you need to make sure that you're doing that. Now, if you're on the other side of it, if you're trying to satisfy many masters, so to speak, I think you've got to think of them as customers. And that's a very common thing too. If you run a business, you probably have more than one customer. Hopefully you have more than one customer. But if you're running an organization within an organization that serves a lot of different department heads or division heads, then think of them as customers. How can you super please them? Realize that they have a choice. In fact, if they're not pleased, ultimately those people could complain and your job could be at risk, or that division could go away, or they outsource everything that you're doing. So remember and treat them as customers. And I think that'll go a long way towards solving the problem. Our last question comes from Timothy.
Hi, my name is Timothy Moser from Owosso, Oklahoma. I'm both a conductor and an entrepreneur working on my platform. My question is about commitment. In college, I tried to start an orchestra with fellow students, and they all loved the idea at first, but later many key members unexpectedly dropped out, so the ensemble fell apart. Now I'm having the same problem with keeping team members on board with projects, even when they say beforehand that they'll commit. Do you have any suggestions for ensuring that commitment is genuine before I rely on team members? Thanks so much. Love your podcast and can't wait to hear the 50th episode.
Timothy, thanks for that question. I know it sounds like this podcast is suddenly become about vision, but it's really true. If you're going to ensure that commitment is genuine before you rely on people, you've got to cast the vision both as a filter and as a way of enrolling them in it. You know, sometimes when you sit down and you're on the recruiting side of it and you cast the vision, if it doesn't resonate with them, they'll disqualify themselves. And that's a good thing. And that's why you want to be clear on the vision, because not everyone is called or qualified to be working with you. So cast a vision and see if it resonates with them. Then I think there are those times where you suddenly find yourself in the midst of a situation where somebody's not performing up to the expectation that you had or that they committed to. And I think you've got to gently and positively confront that in a way that makes them clear that there's an issue, that they need to address it. And so you just can't rely usually on the vision. You've got to have some more direct intervention with some people. And sometimes things change. You know, people get overcommitted. They have something that happens in their life that doesn't allow them to stay committed. And I think you've got to address that honestly too, and not just carry those people along when they're not performing, because it really hurts the rest of the team and it discourages everyone else as well. So you've got to speak to that and sometimes even remove a team member if they're no longer contributing or living up to their commitment. And those are difficult decisions. Those are difficult conversations. But this really marks you as a leader and someone who's prepared to the next level. And that really comes back to courage. So I would encourage you to do that. Well, what lesson from a symphony leader do you need to apply to your own leadership to become a better leader? And to comment on this episode, to answer that question, go to my blog at michaelhyatt.com/50, episode 50. Can't believe we're this far along, but michaelhyatt.com/50. Three quick announcements. We've opened up a couple of more speaking dates for this year. We've got it basically booked, but I'm working on a new book, a new online course, so my staff is really being stingy with my time. But I love speaking, and I've convinced them to open up a few more dates for the summer and fall. And if you're interested in having me speak at an upcoming event, please check out my speaking page at michaelhyatt.com/speaking. And there you'll find a list of my most requested speaking topics, some video clips of me speaking in front of a live audience, numerous endorsements, and of course, a calendar of all my upcoming speaking engagements. Announcement number two, if you're considering launching your own platform, and I've talked about that a lot in these 50 episodes, you need to start with a self-hosted WordPress blog. It's not as complicated as it sounds. In fact, I put together a step-by-step screencast on exactly how to do it. You don't need any technical knowledge. I walk you through that entire process in exactly 20 minutes. The screencast is absolutely free, and you can find it at michaelhyatt.com/WordPress setup, all one word, /WordPress setup. Finally, my next podcast will be on the topic of how to build or rebuild trust. Trust is what makes everything work in an organization. With it, you can accomplish terrific things, and without it, everything falls apart. We're going to be talking about trust in the next episode, and if you've got a question about this topic, please leave me a voicemail message at michaelhyatt.com/podcast question. And this, by the way, is a terrific way to cross-promote your blog or your website because I'll link to it just like I did with the callers in this episode. Well, that's about it for this episode, this 50th episode of This Is Your Life. I'd be so grateful if you would rate my podcast on iTunes. If you've not already done that, that keeps the podcast visible so that other people within iTunes can discover it on their own. And if you'd like to comment on this episode, please go to michaelhyatt.com/50. Go to the show notes for this episode, scroll down to the comment section, and I'd love to hear from you, whether it's a comment, a question, or whatever. But until next time, remember, your life is a gift. Now go make it count. This is your